October 16th, 1987, Indiana, Pennsylvania. Jack Davis Jr., a 20-year-old sophomore at Indiana University of Pennsylvania, spends the night partying and drinking with members of his fraternity, but never returns to his apartment. 5 days later, Jack's body is found at the bottom of an exterior stairwell on campus, and the county coroner concludes that he passed out there while intoxicated and choked to death on his own vomit. However, there are a number of discrepancies which make Jack's family suspect his body was placed in that stairwell after he died, and the investigation is eventually reopened. When Jack's body is exhumed, a number of unexplained fractures are discovered on his skull, but the actual circumstances of how Jack died remain unclear. After that, the trail went cold. Happy New Year, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be kicking off 2021 by exploring an odd case involving a university student, the unexplained 1987 death of Jack Davis Jr. This case was featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and ever since the inception of this podcast, I've received numerous requests to cover it. Jack Davis Jr. was a sophomore at Indiana University of Pennsylvania who went missing after spending the night partying and drinking. When Jack's body was discovered at the bottom of a university stairwell 5 days later, his death was initially ruled to be a tragic accident and that he choked to death on his own vomit. However, there were a number of troubling questions, as it seemed unlikely Jack's body could have remained at the bottom of the stairwell on a busy campus for that length of time without anyone noticing him. The case eventually captured the attention of noted forensic pathologist Dr. Cyril Wecht, and after Jack's body was exhumed, he came to the conclusion that Jack was likely alive for a couple days after he originally went missing, and that his death was actually the result of a brain hemorrhage caused by some unexplained skull fractures. This strongly suggested that Jack died at another location before someone planted his body in the stairwell, but if so, what actually happened to him, and who was responsible? An extensive investigation was performed by freelance reporter Marlene Gentilcor, who published a book about this case titled Justice Wanted, The Kid in the University Stairwell. But even though Jack's death has always been surrounded by a lot of hearsay and rumors about an alleged cover-up, there seem to be very few verifiable facts, so we're going to explore this perplexing case on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the death of Jack Davis Jr. Our story begins in Pennsylvania in 1987, and our central figure is 20-year-old Jack Davis Jr. Jack originally hails from the township of Penn Hills in Allegheny County, and his father, Jack Davis Jr., and mother, Elaine Lynch, would divorce shortly after he was born. Jack Jr. had no biological siblings, but when he was only 2 years old, he would find himself with several step-siblings after his mother got remarried to another man who had six kids of his own. After being raised by his new family and graduating high school, Jack decided to move to Indiana County in order to attend Indiana University of Pennsylvania, more commonly known as IUP. At this point, Jack is a sophomore majoring in business and lives in an off-campus apartment with four roommates. He is also a member of the Sigma Tau Gamma fraternity, more commonly known as Sig Tau, and on the evening of Friday, October the 16th, Jack drove to a party at an off-campus sorority house alongside another member of his fraternity who functioned as his mentor and was often referred to as his quote-unquote big brother. While there, they were joined by some other fraternity brothers, and a group of them decided to leave the party with Jack shortly before 11:30 p.m. in order to walk to a tavern in downtown Indiana called Al Patty's. Throughout the course of the night, Jack consumed a lot of alcohol, and sometime after arriving at the tavern, he would get into an altercation with another student. Since Jack was technically still under the legal drinking age of 21, he would be escorted out of Al Patty's and not allowed back inside. Jack then decided to walk across the street to another bar named Calico's, but he would soon disappear and never return to his apartment that night. When Jack failed to surface over the weekend, his roommates just assumed he had taken a trip somewhere, but they started to become concerned once they learned that Jack did not attend any of his classes on Monday, October the 19th. Jack was officially reported missing to the Indiana Borough Police Department that night, and his family would be informed about what was happening. Jack's car was soon discovered in the exact same place he had parked when he attended the party at the sorority house on Friday night. By the afternoon of Wednesday, October the 21st, Jack's disappearance had been publicized, so a student named Tom Brennan came forward to police and shared some information about having crossed paths with him. Sometime between 1 and 1:30 a.m. on Saturday, October the 17th, Brennan claimed that he came across Jack leaning up against the wall outside Calico's bar and that he looked intoxicated. At the time, a small scuffle was taking place outside the bar, and Jack appeared to be angry and openly stated that he wanted to fight members of a rival fraternity named Phi Delt. Brennan said he prevented Jack from getting involved in the scuffle, which was soon broken up by the police, and he offered to walk Jack back home. After they left the scene, Brennan asked Jack where he lived several times, but Jack refused to answer, so Brennan escorted him to Elkin Hall, which was his own dormitory on campus. Brennan said that he went inside the dorm to check with a friend to see if Jack could spend the night there, but when he went back outside, Jack was gone. By the time Brennan came forward and shared his story, Jack's family had made the trip from Penn Hills to Indiana, so later that same evening, they decided to organize a search effort of the IUP campus, which consisted of numerous volunteers, including students who belonged to Jack's fraternity. They broke off into groups, but at around 10:20 p.m., three of Jack's fraternity brothers would discover his body at the bottom of an exterior 12-foot stairwell located next to a campus courtyard. The stairwell was rarely used and had 15 concrete steps, which led to a 10-foot-wide landing, followed by another 5 steps to the bottom, located next to the entrance of a mechanical room. The room belonged to an adjacent building named Wayand Hall, containing a number of classrooms and labs for science courses, and the stairwell was only about a block away from where Jack had parted ways with Tom Brennan. While the Indiana Borough Police took charge of the investigation while Jack was missing, the discovery of his body at this location meant that the campus police would have jurisdiction investigating his death. A local pathologist named Dr. Stephen Griffin would perform an autopsy on Jack's body and sent the results to Indiana County Coroner Thomas Streams, who ruled Jack's death to be an accident. Aside from a small hematoma above Jack's left eyebrow, there were no signs of bruises, defensive wounds, or drag marks on Jack's body to indicate that he had been involved in a struggle or was the victim of foul play. Based on the timeline of Tom Brennan's eyewitness account, Streams theorized that Jack's death took place at approximately 2 a.m. on October the 17th. He suspected that after Brennan went inside Elkin Hall, Jack walked across campus until he reached the stairwell and decided to walk down there in order to urinate. However, since he was intoxicated, Jack wound up passing out and vomiting, and subsequently asphyxiated after inhaling the vomit into his lungs. While Jack's family had a number of problems with this scenario, and had a hard time believing that his body could have remained undiscovered inside the stairwell of a busy campus for 5 whole days. In spite of this, most of them reluctantly accepted the accidental death ruling, but the situation ate away at one of Jack's stepbrothers, John Lynch. In December of 1989, John was put in touch with Marlene Gentilcore, a freelance reporter with the Greensburg Tribune Review, and he convinced her that there had to be more to this story. They would launch their own deep dive investigation into Jack's death, and Gentilcore uncovered a number of troubling discrepancies, so the Tribune Review decided to publish a 3-part series of articles about her findings in April of 1990. The case eventually wound up in the hands of Dr. Cyril Wecht, one of the most famous forensic pathologists in the United States, who also happened to work in Allegheny County, where Jack's family lived. Right from the outset, Dr. Wecht was troubled by Jack's original toxicology and autopsy reports. For starters, there was an odd discrepancy in the autopsy report, because even though Indiana County Coroner Thomas Streams had listed Jack's probable time of death as 2 a.m. on October the 17th, the original pathologist who performed the autopsy, Dr. Stephen Griffin, had listed it at 2 a.m. on October the 18th. Even though it was conclusively established that Jack had been drinking heavily on the last night he was seen alive, the toxicology report showed no traces of alcohol in Jack's blood and only small amounts in his stomach and urine. In Wecht's eyes, this ruled out the possibility that Jack could have died during the early morning hours of October the 17th, as he believed it would have taken at least 30 hours for all the alcohol in Jack's system to have metabolized. In addition, both the autopsy and toxicology reports described Jack as having a large amount of stomach contents, which made Wecht believe that Jack had eaten something only 5 hours or so before he died. This meant that if Jack's death had occurred 5 days before the autopsy was performed, his stomach contents would have already been digested. Wecht was particularly troubled by the amount of stubble which was on Jack's face in the photographs of his body, as a number of witnesses who interacted with Jack before he disappeared maintained that he was clean-shaven that night. These photographs, as well as the slides of Jack's body tissue, also made Wecht conclude that Jack's body was not in a state of decomposition one would expect after being dead 5 days. In fact, he believed Jack was still in the rigor mortis phase, which seemed to indicate that he had been dead for less than 24 hours at the time those photos were taken. Another odd discrepancy was that Jack's clothing was dry at the time he was found, even though there had been heavy rainfall the day before. Dr. Wecht also completely dismissed Thomas Streams' original ruling about Jack's cause of death when he looked at the autopsy slides of Jack's lungs, which showed no traces of food particles in his windpipe or esophagus, and seemed to poke a hole in the theory that Jack had regurgitated food prior to his death and choked on his own vomit. However, the biggest red flag for Wecht was when he looked at the original autopsy report and noticed that Dr. Griffin had not opened up the cranial vault of Jack's skull to check for possible head injuries. This prompted Wecht to convince the Davis family to have Jack's body exhumed, and they would finally be given approval to do so in November of 1990, when the Indiana County District Attorney agreed to reopen the investigation into Jack's death. After the exhumation, Dr. Wecht would perform a new autopsy, and after opening Jack's cranial vault, he discovered a total of 3 fractures in Jack's skull. A 3-inch-long fracture at the back of his head, a 1-inch fracture above his left ear, and a 1-inch fracture inside the sinus cavity behind his nose. Wecht concluded that these fractures had caused a large subdural hemorrhage on the right side of Jack's brain, which led to a blood clot and ultimately his death. However, Wecht did not believe that Jack's injuries were caused by a fall down the stairwell, as that would have created what he described as quote-unquote eggshell depressed type fractures in his skull, and Jack did not have any noticeable abrasions or bruises on his body. Unfortunately, it also turned out that Jack's organs were now missing. Even though it was standard procedure to remove organs before an autopsy, and put them back inside the body before it was buried. This was not done in Jack's case, so no one knew where his organs went. These new discoveries prompted Weck to pay a visit to the campus of Indiana University of Pennsylvania to check out the stairwell where Jack's body was found. He also entered a second-floor classroom inside the adjacent Wayant Hall, which had a window that directly overlooked the stairwell and a clear, unobstructed view of the bottom. Since approximately 200 students visited the classroom in the days following Jack's disappearance, Weck found it extremely unlikely that no one would have noticed Jack's body during the five-day window he was missing. While Weck still thought that the injuries were more consistent with some sort of fall rather than a blow to the head, he suspected that Jack's death occurred at another location a couple days after he originally disappeared, before someone placed his body at the bottom of the stairwell. Weck stated, quote, "The fact that he lived 2 or 3 days tells you that the injuries were not immediately fatal, and that, in retrospect, had he been afforded good medical care with the appropriate neurosurgeon, most likely he would have survived," end quote. In spite of Weck's new findings, Jack's family were unable to file any wrongful death or negligence lawsuits against anyone because the 2-year statute of limitations had expired. Even though the Indiana County District Attorney reopened the investigation, they failed to turn up any new evidence to prove that Jack's death was the result of foul play, so the investigation was pretty much closed again after 1 year. However, after interviewing several people who attended IUP during this time period, Marlene Gentlecore heard a number of unsettling rumors about what might have happened to Jack. It turned out that Jack's fraternity, Sig Tau, was not officially recognized by the university because nearly 1 year before Jack's death, they had been suspended from campus and lost their national charter due to an incident where they broke into a rival fraternity house and caused extensive damage. For this reason, Sig Tau was known as a quote-unquote renegade fraternity and had a reputation for causing trouble and getting into fights. Jack's family was never pleased with him being associated with this fraternity, particularly after an incident during Jack's freshman year where he attended a rock concert with them in Pittsburgh. Jack's fraternity brothers made an attempt to steal some t-shirts, but when they were caught in the act, they proceeded to toss the shirts into Jack's arms and run away. As a result, Jack took all the heat for the incident and was arrested, so he had to call his mother to bail him out. You might recall that on the night Jack went missing, he made reference to a scuffle having taken place between members of Sig Tau and Phi Delt, and while the university tried to downplay the whole incident as nothing more than a quote-unquote shouting match, other witnesses said it was a lot more violent than that, and a total of 5 fights were reported to have taken place on campus that night. Indeed, when Jack's fraternity brothers attended his funeral, his family noticed that a number of them had black eyes and bruises on their faces. This is why one of the most prevalent rumors was that Jack was seriously injured during one of these fights, so the responsible parties kept him hidden somewhere for days in an attempt to nurse him back to health. But Jack ultimately succumbed to his injuries, so his body was placed in the stairwell in order to make it look like he had been the victim of an accidental fall. However, it seemed like most of the students who shared these rumors were reluctant to go on the record and speak out for fear of retaliation against them by Sig Tau. While interviewing one of Jack's former roommates, Gentlecore learned a number of unsavory things about Jack's mentor at the fraternity, aka his big brother, as he was reportedly known for being a major cocaine dealer on campus. On the night he went missing, Jack and his big brother had driven to the party at the sorority house together and spent a good chunk of the night hanging out before they went their separate ways. But oddly, when his body was found, Jack was wearing his big brother's fraternity jacket, which had that person's name on the front. When interviewed by police, this guy claimed that shortly after they arrived at Al Patty's Tavern, he and Jack briefly left there in order to stop by Jack's apartment so he could change clothes. While there, Jack asked his big brother if he could wear his fraternity jacket and put it on before they returned to the tavern together. But at least one witness from the sorority party told Gentlecore that Jack was already wearing the fraternity jacket when he first arrived there, because everyone noticed the Big Brother's name on the front and teased him about it. The case would be featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, which aired in January of 1995, and the Indiana County District Attorney said he would follow up on any new leads which might be produced as a result of the episode. In fact, weeks later, the District Attorney's office received an anonymous letter written by someone claiming to be a former IUP student who said that a friend of theirs once told them that Jack had died at a house where some fraternity brothers lived, and they kept him in a closet for a couple of days while they figured out what to do. The Unsolved Mysteries Telecenter would receive numerous phone tips just like that one, which alleged that Jack's death was caused by his fraternity, but none of the callers were willing to leave their name or contact information, and as a result, these tips went nowhere. Years later, a message would be left at Dr. Weck's office by a man claiming to be a retired Indiana Borough police officer who said that Jack had come to him for protection 2 weeks prior to his death. While Marlene Gentilcore was able to confirm this police officer's identity, she was unable to make contact with him, and as far as I can tell, he never revealed any further details about his encounter with Jack. In 2011, Gentilcore finally published a book about the case titled Justice Wanted, The Kid in the University Stairwell, but it failed to bring about any substantial new leads, and after more than 30 years, we still don't know the full truth about what actually caused the death of Jack Davis Jr. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So Unsolved Mysteries featured its fair share of stories about young people who went missing for a long period of time after attending a party, and when their body was eventually discovered, no one could figure out the exact circumstances of how they died. In all of these cases, the authorities did not think that any foul play had taken place, that their body could have remained undiscovered at the location they were found the entire time they were missing. For this reason, they suspected that some sort of cover-up had taken place. Of course, one of the most famous examples of this, which I covered on the podcast about 4 years ago, was the 1981 death of Kurt Sova, who disappeared after attending a party before his body was discovered in a ravine 5 days later. You can make a number of parallels between Kurt's case and what happened to Jack Davis Jr., as they both went out partying on a Friday night and were believed to have gotten intoxicated before their bodies were found the following Wednesday. On the reboot of Unsolved Mysteries, which dropped on Netflix last year, one of their episodes covered the 2004 death of Alonzo Brooks, who also vanished after attending a party before his body was discovered in a creek nearly 1 month later. In both the Kurt Sova and Alonzo Brooks cases, people were adamant that they had previously searched the areas in which the bodies were found, but saw nothing, leading to suspicion that their bodies were planted there at a later time. This logic also applies to the Jack Davis Jr. case, but the key difference is that while no one could really determine an exact cause of death for Kurt or Alonzo, we've had differing opinions with Jack, as it was initially believed he choked on his own vomit, before Dr. Cyril Wecht concluded that it was the result of a brain hemorrhage caused by the skull fractures. I would definitely concur with Wecht's opinion on this one, and it's really troubling that no one bothered to open up the cranial vault of Jack's skull to perform a thorough examination before he was buried. If those fractures had been discovered the first time around, it could have changed the course of the original investigation, but it seemed the authorities were content to write off Jack's death as a tragic accident and move on. In a lot of these cases where a victim's death is ruled to be suicide or an accident, their loved ones are vocal from day one that foul play took place. Here, it's apparent that Jack's family did have issues with the official cover story about his death, but it seems like they were content to accept it and move on until Jack's stepbrother, John, enlisted the services of Marlene Gentilcore, whose own independent investigation pretty much changed the course of the entire case. Reading her book, Justice Wanted, you can definitely sense the constant frustration that she and Jack's family had to face, because it seemed like they kept getting stonewalled at every turn, and you sense that a number of people just wanted the case to go away and be forgotten. Indeed, even though their efforts got the investigation reopened, and they received assistance from the likes of Cyril Wecht and Unsolved Mysteries, they really are no closer to solving this case and receiving conclusive answers than they were 3 decades ago. One of the biggest issues with figuring out what actually happened to Jack is that his death seemed to be surrounded by a ton of rumors and hearsay, much of it provided by anonymous sources who did not want to go on the record. The most prevalent rumor is that Jack's quote-unquote renegade fraternity, Sigma Tau Gamma, was somehow involved, and that when something bad happened to Jack on the night he went missing, he was kept hidden somewhere until he died a few days later, and his body was subsequently dumped in the stairwell where he was found. The Indiana County coroner, Thomas Streams, was the one who came up with the theory about Jack passing out in the stairwell and choking on his vomit. While Streams received a lot of blowback from his ruling, he always maintained that he based it on the report from the original pathologist, Dr. Stephen Griffin, who sounded ridiculously unqualified. The one detail from Griffin's report which never made sense to anybody is that Jack supposedly had no alcohol in his blood, even though there were traces of it in his stomach and urine, which pretty much seems impossible. Here's how Streams addressed the situation in an inquest. Quote, "When I first saw this report, I was confused to why there was no alcohol indicated in the blood, when there was in the gastric contents and in the urine. When we met with Dr. Griffin for him to explain that to us, his interpretation of this was that the body metabolized during the time between death and when the body was found. The red blood cells and the white blood cell still continue to work, perhaps that would be a good way to say it, after death occurs." End quote. Well, there's an amusing passage in Justice Wanted where Marlene Gentilcore describes reading this quote to Cyril Wecht during a phone conversation, and Wecht responds by going on an angry, profanity-filled rant about the absurdity of that explanation and how Dr. Griffin had no idea what he was talking about. As far as Wecht was concerned, Jack could have only died after all the alcohol metabolized out of his body, meaning that at the very least, he was still alive for about a day and a half after he went missing. However, it's worth mentioning that bacteria can produce alcohol after a body decays, causing a deceased person's blood alcohol level to rise. So theoretically, even if Jack didn't drink anything at all before he died, alcohol still could have shown up in his system if his body started decomposing. But the problem, of course, is that there didn't appear to be much, if any, decomposition on Jack's body when he was found, even though he had supposedly been dead for 5 days. So no matter how you look at it, the timeline and the evidence just does not seem to support the conclusions of Griffin or Streams. Wecht has always maintained that the amount of stubble on Jack's face is the strongest piece of evidence that he was alive for a couple days after he disappeared, but there is reason to be skeptical of this as well. Even though a number of people who interacted with Jack on the night he went missing were certain that he was clean-shaven at the time, you have to remember that many of them were drinking and could have misremembered this detail. And it's also worth mentioning that a person's facial hair can appear to be thicker after death, not because it continued to grow, but because the skin and soft tissue surrounding the hair can shrink and retract, giving off the false appearance of growth. The way the original Unsolved Mysteries segment about this story was structured was that it spent the first few minutes talking about Cyril Wecht and his background before it delved into Jack's case and Dr. Wecht's work on the investigation. So obviously, it was produced in such a way to portray Wecht in the best possible light, but even though he has undoubtedly had a long and storied career and examined thousands of cases, some of which are among the most famous murders of all time, it's not like he's been without controversy. Wecht was one of the biggest critics of the Warren Commission's conclusions about the assassination of John F. Kennedy, as he never believed that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone, and he has always claimed that Kurt Cobain's death was murder, not a suicide. Obviously, not everyone is going to agree with those conclusions. All that being said, on this particular case, I would definitely agree a lot more with Wecht than Stephen Griffin or Thomas Streams. Since there were no food particles found in Jack's air passages, it seems very unlikely that he would have choked to death on his own vomit, so Wecht's conclusions about the brain hemorrhage caused by skull fractures seems like the correct one. But the big question is, where did these fractures come from? Well, even if Jack's death was purely accidental and no foul play was involved, you can definitely understand why there might have been a cover-up, because at 20 years old, Jack was still technically below the legal drinking age. One of the most bizarre side stories of this case, which I have not discussed yet, is some legal action which was taken against Al Patties, one of the taverns Jack visited on the night he disappeared. Months after Jack's body was found, the Pennsylvania State Police Bureau of Liquor Control Enforcement filed a complaint against one of the bartenders at Al Patties over allegations that he served alcohol to Jack that night. A preliminary hearing took place, but even though there were reportedly around 20 witnesses who had seen Jack drinking at the tavern, only one witness, an IUP student, agreed to show up and testify against the bartender. The witness was shown a photo lineup inside the courtroom, and when he failed to correctly pick out the bartender, the case was dismissed. But here's the really weird part. When the photo lineup was taking place, a man dressed in a suit and tie was sitting in the courtroom next to the bartender's defense attorney, but the real bartender was actually outside, waiting in the hallway. Well, wouldn't you know it, a picture of the man in the suit and tie was included in the photo lineup, and this is the picture that the eyewitness picked out. So it seemed like a conscious decision was made to bring an imposter into the courtroom in order to fool the witness into identifying the wrong man. You'd think that the prosecution would have strenuously objected to a tactic like this, but they apparently let the whole thing slide and let the case get dismissed. I mean, I have no idea if this whole charade is a completely separate, unrelated incident which has no connection to Jack's death, but it's incredibly bizarre and just gives off the impression that something hinky was going on. It's almost like they were going through some sort of charade to give Jack's family the false impression that someone would be held accountable for his death, but they didn't actually want to go through the process of punishing anyone. It's also worth noting that Jack's original autopsy found traces of cocaine in his system, though they were apparently quite small, and this is the actual wording which was used in the report. Quote, "A metabolite of cocaine was found, indicating the usage of cocaine. However, presence of the metabolite in the blood without the parent compound makes it difficult to accurately define the influence of the substance on an individual." End quote. Given that Jack's quote-unquote big brother at the fraternity was rumored to be a cocaine dealer on campus, this detail is particularly interesting, but even if Jack did use some drugs, it's unclear if it could have played any role in his death. When Marlene Gentlecore spoke to one of Jack's former roommates, he recounted one occasion in the past where Jack did try cocaine, but he was apparently left quite frightened by how fast it made his heart beat, and he gave off the impression that he had no desire to try it again. Another frustrating aspect of the original investigation is how Thomas Streams determined that Jack's probable time of death was at around 2 a.m. on Saturday, October the 17th. But the problem is that he seemingly based this time on nothing more than the word of Tom Brennan, the last confirmed witness to have seen Jack alive. As you recall, Brennan claimed that Jack was very intoxicated when they crossed paths, and he tried to make arrangements for Jack to spend the night at his dorm, Elkin Hall, but Jack gave him the slip and took off. Given that Elkin Hall was located on campus only about a block away from the stairwell, then yes, the timeline would fit Streams' scenario of Jack walking down the stairs and passing out there. But is Tom Brennan's account 100% accurate? Well, on the surface, there's no reason to believe that Brennan's not telling the truth, as he did an interview with the Indiana Gazette following the discovery of Jack's body, and it sounds like he was cooperative with the police and had no issues openly sharing his story with Marlene Gentlecore when she contacted him years later. But it must be noted that there's a passage in Justice Wanted where Gentlecore mentions that when she spoke with one of Jack's former roommates, he said this about Brennan. Quote, I know the guy, and I wouldn't trust him as far as I can throw him. End quote. Indeed, there are a few contradictions with Brennan's story. Brennan told Gentilcore that he didn't know Jack that well, but during his original statement to police, he told them he had known Jack for about a year and had been drinking with him several times. And when the Indiana Gazette published a story about this case years after the fact, a former female IUP student came forward and claimed that on the night Jack went missing, she saw him at a party at the Sig Tau fraternity house sometime between 12:30 and 1 a.m. The student claimed that Jack and his fraternity brothers left the party and went outside to participate in a fight with a rival fraternity, Phi Delt, but when the fraternity brothers returned to the house, Jack was not with them, and she never saw him again. Well, Brennan claimed that when he encountered Jack outside Coleco's bar, Jack made mention about wanting to fight Phi Delt, but the problem is that, as far as I can tell, even though Jack can be placed at a sorority house party and at least two downtown taverns that night, this student is the only person who has ever placed Jack at the Sig Tau fraternity party. So could this female student have been misremembering things? Or is Brennan not telling the entire truth about his encounter with Jack? There's also another eyewitness account which seems to contradict this student's story, because when Jack was kicked out of Al Patty's tavern and walked across the street to Coleco's, he supposedly crossed paths with two other female sorority students who claimed that Jack uttered these odd words, quote, "Gee, thanks, guys. You just saved me. You just saved my life," end quote. So could Jack have stopped by the fraternity party after this conversation and then returned to Coleco's at a later time? Or could Jack have actually gone there after parting ways with Brennan? I will say that there is one detail about Brennan's account which seems to poke a hole in the original cover story about Jack's death. Thomas Stream speculated that the reason Jack walked down the stairwell in the first place was to relieve himself, but here's an exact quote of Cyril Weck's response to that theory during his Unsolved Mysteries interview. Quote, "The other thing that puzzled me was I thought, gee, why would a young man in the early hours of the morning walk 15 steps down a landing and another 5 steps to urinate? I remember when I went to college, and I remember what young men will do when they have to urinate if they are inebriated. Not too many people have that kind of discretion and personal sensitivity," end quote. Of course, this should just be taken as a personal assumption on Dr. Weck's part rather than a hard fact, as not everyone is going to act the same way when they're drunk. But this idea is supported by Tom Brennan's story, as he claimed that while they were walking together that night, Jack briefly stopped to urinate on someone's lawn. He apparently did it right out there in the open and made no attempt at discretion, so yes, it does seem less likely that Jack would then later decide to walk down a stairwell in order to conceal himself. A detail about Brennan's account, which always bothered Marlene Gentilcore, is that he described Jack as hiding in the bushes when he went inside Alcon Hall, which seemed to imply that Jack was attempting to avoid someone. And like I just mentioned, when Jack encountered those two female sorority students outside Al Patty's, he made a comment about them having saved his life. That comment is particularly interesting when you remember that Jack had been removed from the tavern for getting into an altercation with another student, so perhaps he was fearful about possible retaliation. Well, in spite of the skull fractures, there were no other noticeable bruises, injuries, and defensive wounds on the rest of Jack's body, aside from a small cut over his left eye, so I don't get the impression that Jack was involved in a violent physical altercation prior to his death. One of the most prevalent rumors was that Jack was killed because of injuries he suffered during a fight with a rival fraternity, but while it seems like such an altercation did take place that night, the biggest issue I have with this theory is that an awful lot of people would need to be involved in the cover-up. It's hard to imagine them being able to keep a secret like this for over 30 years without saying anything, so whatever happened to Jack, I suspect that only a small handful of individuals know the full truth. While Dr. Weck did conclude that Jack's head injuries were more consistent with a fall than a blow, he found it unlikely that they were caused by him falling down the stairwell. If he had stumbled from near the top, there was a 10-foot landing 15 steps below, which would have broken his fall, and there were only 5 other steps below that, so I was his body on the bottom. No matter how you interpret the physical evidence, I still have an incredibly hard time believing that Jack could have been in that stairwell during the entire 5 days he was missing. If he died early Saturday morning, I could buy that he remained undiscovered over the weekend, but he was not found until Wednesday night. This means that people were attending class at the adjacent Wyant Hall for 3 days, and no one saw Jack, even though there were windows directly overlooking the stairwell. But if Jack's body was deliberately placed there after he died, what caused his injuries, and where was he during that 5-day window? Well, it's possible the truth leads back to Jack's renegade fraternity, Sigma Tau Gamma, as it sounds like a number of people felt Jack was too nice of a person to be associated with such a group of troublemakers. In retrospect, a number of people from Jack's personal life now believe he was giving off the impression that he wanted to leave the fraternity, but felt there might be consequences if he tried to quit. As an example, Jack was particularly close with one of his former high school teachers and his wife, whom he almost considered to be his second parents. They both claimed that in the weeks prior to his death, Jack phoned them a number of times and would ask if they needed him to return to Penn Hills to help them with anything on the weekends. Jack's mother, Elaine, also recalled receiving phone calls just like that, in which Jack appeared to be reaching for a reason for her to ask him to come home. They described Jack as sounding troubled during these calls, and the implication seemed to be that if they gave him a convenient excuse to travel to Penn Hills on the weekends, then he wouldn't have to spend that time hanging out and partying with his fraternity brothers, who were likely involved in some unsavory activities. Indeed, the 4 roommates Jack was living with at that time were not members of Sig Tau, and he gave off the impression that he was trying to disassociate himself from the fraternity. The most frustrating lead in this case is the message from the retired Indiana Borough police officer who claimed that Jack asked him for protection 2 weeks before he died, but this man has never gone on the record or provided any specific details about why Jack needed protection or who he was afraid of. But if he was telling the truth, the fact that a retired police officer got cold feet about speaking out suggests there was a culture of fear pervading over Indiana County during this time period, and it might explain why so few people have been willing to talk. Even though he has never been named publicly, Jack's big brother from the fraternity seems to be a key figure in this story. It's unclear if he had an alibi that night, but the official story seems to be that Jack and his big brother spent the first part of the evening at the sorority party, but got separated after Jack was kicked out of Alpani's. Since the big brother was reportedly a major cocaine dealer on campus, and Jack was found wearing his fraternity jacket, one possible theory is that Jack may have been the victim of mistaken identity. If this other guy had made some enemies, who noticed that Jack was wearing a jacket with his name on it, they could have decided to attack him before they realized it was the wrong person. If they caused some serious injuries, they may have taken Jack somewhere and attempted to nurse him back to health over the next few days before he passed away. If you remember the episode I previously released about the death of Kurt Sova, one of the most prominent theories in that case is that Kurt attended a party at a duplex and spent a couple of days recovering on a cot inside the basement, possibly because he had a negative reaction to some alcohol he drank there. Since Kurt was only 17 years old, and well below the legal drinking age, the people who hosted the party may have thought there would be a lot of blowback if they took him to get proper medical attention, which is why they hoped they could nurse him back to health on their own. But when things didn't go as planned, and Kurt died, they took his body to a nearby ravine and dumped it there. Well, you have to wonder if a similar situation happened with Jack, though his issues could have been caused by a head injury, not alcohol. The fact that Jack had undigested stomach contents at the time of his death seems to indicate that he was being fed by whoever was taking care of him. Now, even though this story has never been confirmed by any official sources, I've seen a few online discussions and comment sections where someone has shared a rumor about Jack being injured during a game of Donkey Kong. Not the famous video game Donkey Kong, but rather a real-life variation of it that Sig Tau liked to stage as a hazing activity, where they would roll a keg of beer down a staircase, and new pledges would have to climb up the steps and jump over it, much like how you have to dodge barrels while playing the video game. Well, rumor has it that Jack got seriously injured while playing this version of Donkey Kong, but instead of giving him medical attention, the responsible parties kept him somewhere for a few days before he died. Now, it sounds like during the first few days Jack was missing, his family had little success at convincing the police to perform a search of the university campus for him, which is why they organized their own search effort on the evening of October the 21st. I know that members of Sig Tau participated in the search, and if they were complicit in what happened to him, perhaps that's why they came up with the idea of planting his body at the bottom of the stairwell. I mean, if Jack died in their care, and they disposed of his body in a manner to ensure he would never be found, Jack would remain a missing person, and the investigation would never close. But by making his death look like an accidental fall, they probably hoped that the investigation would be closed immediately, and for the first few years, this strategy actually worked. And even though the investigation was eventually reopened, and this story received exposure on national television, no one has ever been made to answer for their role in Jack's death. Look, I do not believe that Jack was murdered intentionally, and can accept that he was the fatal victim of a freak accident, but by covering up the truth about what happened, the responsible parties caused a lot of undue pain for Jack's family. His stepbrother John said it was particularly hurtful when they attended Jack's funeral, and the priest decided to take the opportunity to make a sermon about the dangers of underage drinking. So in a way, it was validation for the family to learn that this was not actually the cause of Jack's death, and he did not suffer the indignity of asphyxiating on his own vomit. While it's tempting to go with Occam's razor and believe that Jack could have died as a result of injuries sustained from an accidental fall down those stairs, I think there are just too many troubling discrepancies to believe this is the case. After 33 years, the statute of limitations for whatever crimes took place here may have expired, so unless this was a deliberate murder, I'm not sure that any charges would be filed, but Jack's loved ones still deserve some answers. So if you happen to have any information about the unexplained death of Jack Davis Jr., please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode about the controversial 1992 death of Michelle Witherall, which took place in Pennsylvania and was investigated by none other than Dr. Cyril Wecht. And for our patrons in tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to take a moment to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon these past several weeks, and they are Joni B, Sharon M, Christy, Jenna, Tim, Hardbop, Farouk A, Stacy C, Joe H, Sylvia M, Imi C, Laura M, and Brandon T. Thank you all so much for your support. I'd also like to announce that later this year, provided that it becomes safe to travel again, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing on Podcast Row at two separate CrimeCon events. The regular CrimeCon, which takes place at the Fairmont Hotel in Austin, Texas from June the 4th until the 6th, and the very first CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London the following weekend on June 12th and the 13th. If you would like to purchase tickets to either event, we have a special promo code you can use to get a 10% discount, and it applies to both the Austin and London events. Either visit crimecon.com or crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code COLD21. That's COLD21. In addition, I also wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after-show for each week's podcast episode, and I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode, and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include the link to these sessions in our show notes of every episode, so be sure to check there for more information, or visit getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foot, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶